Hello, this is Belinda Rhodes with Guardian Daily on Monday, December the 22nd. Today, less than a month after the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, two of the hotels targeted by gunmen reopen. But those who were hurt or lost friends and family have not forgotten the trauma.
He turned around and he held his gun at me. And then, like, you know, like a jackass, I sat up because I knew, you know, this is it. And then we exchanged a look and he fired.
A new exhibition in London explores the issues behind GM foods. But who has got the science and politics right?
I actually think the American technology might run into the sands because it's so focused upon monocropping, so tacked into and locked into oil-guzzling American intensive agriculture, that actually GM in America is probably not going to survive as long as its adherents think.
And as Boris Johnson prepares to enjoy his first Christmas as London mayor, is he getting the balance right between listening and leading?
There is a conflict. We're not going to pretend there isn't a conflict between, you know, wanting to listen to the boroughs and wanting to set clear priorities. The conflict often doesn't pose itself in the way that it might.
Our London blogger Dave Hill has more on Boris's first 7 months. But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Hospitals haven't received tens of millions of pounds of extra funding for urgently needed improvements to their maternity services, according to the country's top midwife. Professor Cathy Warwick says the funding gap means the NHS will not be able to honour government pledges to give women in England world-class care by 2010. A spokesman from the Department for Health played down the significance of the unpaid millions, but refused to confirm if the government still expects the project to be delivered on time. Professor Warwick's comments come after a series of reports exposed serious failings in the quality of maternity care in some British hospitals. Plans for a major government rescue package for Jaguar Land Rover may be put on hold after the company's Indian owners indicated they are prepared to make an emergency cash injection. Lord Mandelson, the business secretary, yesterday warned the company's owners must look to their own resources and pass tough tests before any state aid would be considered. Canada's followed the United States in bailing out its motor industry as the economic downturn has seen car sales dry up around the globe. Follow this story as it develops at guardian.co.uk/business. The Conservative Party is demanding an apology from the head of Britain's counter-terrorism unit. Assistant Commissioner Bob Quick blamed the Conservatives and their supporters for acting in a wholly corrupt way to try to undermine his investigation into Damien Green. He claims the party helped place a story in the Mail on Sunday that enabled his family home to be identified. Quick has retracted his allegation about corruption, but he declined to withdraw the claim that the party had inspired the story. Senior figures in the Conservative Party indicated they were prepared to mount legal action to clear the party name. 2009's Christmas number one slot has been taken by the winner of this year's X Factor, Alexandra Burke. A cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah sold 576,000 copies to reach the top spot, ahead of another reissue of the same song, covered by Jeff Buckley. Burke can now also claim to have the fastest selling single by a solo female artist. In football, Premier League leaders Liverpool were held to a 1-1 draw with Arsenal at the Emirates Stadium. Robbie Keane equalised for the visitors after Robin van Persie had put Arsenal ahead. Chelsea face Everton this evening, knowing a win would put them top of the league. Follow it live from 8 p.m. at guardian.co.uk/football. Now for a look at today's papers, and the Telegraph reports Britain's armed forces have suffered four times as many casualties as their American allies in the past 7 weeks. A Royal Marine yesterday became the 14th soldier to be killed in Afghanistan since the 1st of November. Bad news for environmentalists in the Financial Times. It quotes Ed Miliband saying Britain will not ban the construction of coal-fired power stations while new technology is being developed to cut their carbon emissions. The Mail leads with news that all GPs will be trained to look for signs of dementia in their patients in an effort to get earlier diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. The Times reports that businessmen blacklisted in the United States over connections to Robert Mugabe are working freely in Britain. Meanwhile, in an editorial, the paper says it's high time David Miliband recognised that international intervention intervention is the only course now available to save more than 7 million people from catastrophe. Britain faces an unemployment bloodbath in the new year, according to a cabinet minister quoted in The Independent. Meanwhile, the Education Secretary Ed Balls was given a dressing down after visiting his old primary school, according to The Sun. He was accosted by one teacher who told him the whole state of education is going downhill rapidly. And finally, in the last weekend before Christmas, The Express reports that millions of shoppers spent £6 billion as retailers continue to slash prices. And there's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Two of the luxury hotels targeted by gunmen in Mumbai less than a month ago have reopened. The Trident and the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel welcomed guests and diners last night for the first time since November's deadly attacks, which have been blamed on Pakistan-based militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba. The other hotel, which came under fire, the Oberoi, is not expected to open for several more months. A multi-faith prayer ceremony was held at the Trident before the reopening, and security was tight for anyone wanting to enter. Randeep Ramesh returned to Mumbai to find out how those involved in the attacks are coping with the memory of the trauma.
3 weeks after gunmen led a rampage through Mumbai, the city awoke yesterday to put the past behind it. In the leafy lanes of Kalaba on the southern tip of the city, there are still signs of the bloodbath. The band of accused Islamic militants killed 164 people over the course of a three-day siege, with several hotels, restaurants and a Jewish centre attacked. But for nearly a month, the injured are still waiting to come home. Ronsley Santhumaya was in the Leopold Cafe on that night. He now lies on the ninth floor of the Bombay Hospital after being shot and left for dead. His right leg, shattered, remains now pinned by steel rods.
But there were a lot of people, so I could kind of, you know, couldn't get complete cover. So my leg was exposed and partially my body. So he came in front and he was looking for survivors and he happened to see me. And then he turned around and he held his gun at me. And then, like, you know, like a jackass, I sat up because I knew, you know, this is it. And then we exchanged a look and he fired. He fired about 4 to 5 rounds. And that one guy, some NRI guy who was in front of me, he got hit in his thigh and I got hit in my leg. You know, at that point in time, I didn't realize that the pain, because, you know, it was more fear. So the pain wasn't really there. It was just like, you know, I knew I got hit, but I dropped as if I was dead, you know. I just thought probably it might just help me, you know, just make him go. And actually, he did walk away. He looked so cold, he didn't look like he wanted to say anything. He just wanted to get his job done.
I haven't seen the crowd, you know. So I don't know if I'm... Because, you know, the day I was transferred from the ICU to this place, I had to pass through two lobbies, you know. And I don't know, for some reason, I was scared. Because when I looked at a crowd of people and I saw some suspicious faces, for some reason, I just, you know, I started, you know, hyperventilating. I was telling my mom that, you know, it was really scary seeing so many people together.
Many have returned back to the Leopold, vowing to make the popular cafe a site of defiance against terror. Spilling onto the streets of this Mumbai neighborhood are backpackers and Indians. Many have drinks in their hands and smiles on their lips, unaware perhaps that just a few weeks ago this place was peppered by grenades and guns. Farhan Jahani was present there on that day. He says that the holes left by the violence are part of history and they'll become part of the new decor of the restaurant.
This is one of the most important marks which we have. 3 bullet shots which are fired from here, and we are not going to touch this at all at this moment. Even at the later stage, we have decided that we will not remove the glass. We'll get it supported by one glass from outside and one glass from inside so that it may not fall or it may not break.
And that's actually 2 quite large bullet holes there.
Yeah, that's for AK-47.
That's an AK-47.
Yes, that's right.
And so where were you? You were standing up there.
I was sitting upstairs on the bar upstairs.
Right. So you could see everything.
I didn't see. I just ducked myself
you
down.
Just ducked down.
Yeah.
Right.
But I know that there were 2 people, because as for what information I got from the people who were in the lane, they said that they were carrying a haversack, and I happened to see just a casual look, because they were standing outside my restaurant for 10 minutes right. with a haversack.
Oh, they were waiting.
They were waiting, yeah. And they were waiting. They had a phone in the hand. Right. It could be that they must be waiting for a phone call or something.
Right.
And after
what
that, this whole thing
happened.
What is bewildering
about Mumbai is the complex mosaic of religions that the militants wanted to tear apart. The attacks on the 26th claimed the first Jewish lives lost in a terror strike in India. The Jewish community in Mumbai stretches back centuries, with many claiming a heritage from Baghdad. There are just 3,000 or 4,000 Jews now left in Mumbai. But after prayers on Saturday, in a beautiful blue-walled synagogue at the heart of Mumbai Jewish life, Solomon Sofer, one of the community's leaders, says that now is the time to come together.
We have had no tensions whatsoever between the Muslims and ourselves at all, at any level. And the Jews are a very friendly kind of people who don't want to interfere with other races or against the Muslims at all at any time. In India, there was no anti-Semitism. And apart from that, there are schools which we are heading. Like, I'm the chairman of the EEE Sassoon High School, where 98% of our students are all Muslims. Muslim parents come and they interact with us. And what is more is, even on the two big Eids celebrations of the Ramzan Eid and the Bakri Eid, I give them free access to pray in the lawns of our compound, which is a Jewish compound.
And that was Randeep Ramesh in Mumbai. And you can find more on that story at guardian.co.uk/India. Also on The Guardian's website today, James Marson writes that criticising Vladimir Putin and hating Russia are not the same thing, while Seamus Milne takes a look at Interpol's dubious list of terror suspects. Both of those are at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And you can follow over-by-over coverage of the fourth day of England's second test against India at guardian.co.uk/sport. But now, where do you stand in the debate over GM foods? An exhibition which will help people explore the issue has just opened at London's Science Museum. It's called Future Foods and examines the current global food crisis as well as the effect of climate change. The Guardian's Andy Duckworth went along to talk to Tim Lang, Professor of Food Technology at London City University, who opened the exhibition. He began by asking him whether the handling of the GM issue has left Britain lagging behind the rest of the world.
I think it's actually brought the UK into a more mature position. I'm a food democrat, not a food controller. I think history shows that ultimately it is people who will decide because they eat. And what we had was, and why I used the word cack-handed, what we had was a classic illustration of a top-down injection of a technology. Oh, here, by the way, here's something we've done, wham, bang, here it is. And then the companies went bonkers when there was, well, why do we need this? Why? What are the implications? What does it do to me? Etc. Perfectly legitimate questions. What we're now in the position, 10, 15 years on, is to be able to say, well, could it be useful for sustainable agriculture? I don't think it'll offer anything to deal with the nutrition problems or urbanisation. I don't think it's got anything to answer critical issues for world food policy like that. But maybe it's got an opportunity to help us speed up the adaptation to some issues associated with climate change. Who knows? I think we should debate it. I don't think we should say it's either Frankenstein or it's the answer to everything, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, as we say. I don't think anything can be pocketed and pigeonholed as crudely as that. The good thing about Britain and Europe is actually we've had a fast learning curve about food in the last 20 years. It's fabulous. We're the most literate food culture now. We're very sophisticated in our understandings of risk, of difficulties, of control, of what we want. We know these complex issues. On the one hand, massive obesity, out of control overweight, alongside massive malnutrition and rising problems of diet-related disease. We can understand all of that. Now let the debate happen again.
We're having this debate here in the UK now. Is it a waste of time since it's already been introduced in the States, which is producing food on a massive scale?
At one level, the horse has bolted. There's no doubt about that. But that taught people like me, or reminded people like me, of a very old lesson in food policy. Whereas when a technology has been developed, if some people say no to it, it'll be dumped on those who have least capacity to resist. there was a great deal of concern about the technology being foisted on developing countries. And the good thing that happened was there's a real north-south developed world, developing world exchange about the issues. And I think in the developing world there's equally a very mature debate going on. I don't think the issue is these big Americans have done it, therefore it's inevitable. I actually think the American technology might run into the sands because it's so focused upon monocropping, so tacked into and locked into big, intensive, oil-guzzling American intensive agriculture, that actually GM in America is probably not going to survive as long as its adherents think. I think even in the US, a sustainable development debate is going to happen over GM. It's already happening, actually, not least due to the genetic pollution issue.
And there's more from Professor Lang, as well as Dr. Emile Frison, Director of Bioversity International, in the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. The Vendée Globe Round the World Yacht Race is back on track after the weekend's drama in which a solo French yachtsman, Yann Elias, who had broken his leg, was rescued by an Australian naval frigate. He had been suffering considerable pain since Thursday after his yacht was hit by a big wave in heavy conditions in the Southern Ocean. Two fellow competitors, British Samantha Davies and French Marc Guillemot, diverted from the course of the race after hearing of his plight to see if they could offer pain-killing drugs or just moral support. But an attempt by Guillemot to throw drugs onto Elias's boat failed, with the painkillers ending up in the sea. Fortunately, however, the Australian Navy reached him on Saturday and took him on board, leaving his yacht on autopilot. Samantha Davies, skippering her yacht Roxy, has made a fine return to full race mode after her attempt to help, organisers say, and will not be penalised for the loss of time. The Guardian's Stephen Morris spoke to her as the rescue attempt was underway and heard that she too had suffered an injury.
I was working inside the boat, moving the gear, and a strop broke, and so I went flying. The strop that I was pulling off broke, and I went flying in. And landed on my elbow on something rather sharp and hard, and it hurt so much that I passed out, which was a bit scary. But later on, I spoke to the race doctor, and he gave me a bollocking for not eating enough, and he said that it's because I haven't eaten enough that my reaction to shock is so bad. So anyway, we checked out my elbow, and it's fine. It's just a really big bruise, and it'll be better in a couple of days, but the real shock is that a good friend and competitor, Jan, has just broken his leg, and so my elbow is not hurting at all now, knowing what he must be going through right now. And we all know, and we knew before we went, that in these really isolated areas in the planet, we are our own rescuers in a lot of cases, and we're all totally aware of that. And we have discussed, you know, how to transfer someone from a stricken vessel onto one of our other boats, and the manoeuvres that we use and the manoeuvres that we all know how to do, so that if ever it came that there was a problem in communication, we could almost do that without having to speak to each other beforehand. So it's something that, it's not something that wasn't already there in the back of my head, and I think the fact of just having, I can just imagine, I was imagining this situation myself, and just having that, having the presence of someone not far away from you, knowing that they're there, must make a big difference in that situation. So
it sounds like the conditions have been horrendous over the past few days and week.
Yeah, they have. They've been horrendous, but Roxy seems to revel in those conditions, and we've been flying, and I've done some really great days, good day runs, and I managed to overtake Ryan, and so I was really chuffed. So although it's physically, it's very, very hard, and the conditions are hard on our bodies and on our boat, it seems that Roxy enjoys it, and she seems to look after me, so I'm still on, although I've got a sore elbow at the moment, I'm still on good form, and I've been well looked after by my boat. And as I was saying, I was talking to Brian earlier, and we were saying how hard it is. But at least when the conditions are that hard, we're going quickly, and so we'll get out of here quicker.
And you're the leading Brit at the moment, aren't you?
I know, but I haven't at all celebrated that because it's so unfortunate. For sure, I'm the leading Brit, but only because of default and through other people's unluckiness. And if I'd have overtaken Mike and he's still out there racing, then I'd be celebrating for sure. But the fact that he dismounted is kind of puts a bit of a dampener on the fact that I'm the leading Brit.
Yachtswoman Samantha Davies talking to Stephen Morris. And although she is doing well, it's worth pointing out that the race still has about 10,000 nautical miles to go. I'm Belinda Rhodes. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come in today's programme, while most people in Britain were battling crowds on the high street and elbowing their way to a Christmas bargain, an older and quieter form of Yule was being celebrated at the country's ancient henges and standing stones.
It's something I've always wanted to do. I've always been interested in stone circles, and it's just a sort of pay our respects.
But first, Boris Johnson has been London's mayor for 7 months now, and Dave Hill, the Guardian's London blogger, has been following his every move. As the year draws to a close, we asked Dave to present a special half-hour audio documentary for Comment is Free about how Boris has done during this time. In the programme, he travels the capital finding that some people have been bitterly disappointed by their new mayor, whilst others pleasantly surprised, like Tony Grew, editor of Pink News, Europe's largest online gay news service.
I'm very impressed with this, with Boris. I think he's done well. I mean, this is what I'd say about him. He's the sort of politician that may not know a lot about some of the groups in London that he now is the mayor of, but he is extremely willing to listen and to try and understand some of the issues that people face without falling into the trap of the previous administration, which unfortunately is identity politics, which is something else that came up during the hustings, was this concept that you can sort of target the gay community, talk about the sort of things you think they might be interested in, pat them on the head and expect their votes. I think one of the breakthroughs for Boris was the idea of turning to the gay community and saying, I understand that gay Londoners are worried about crime and housing, just as much as they're worried about whether or not their Pride Parade gets funding. That had a strong appeal after 10 years, 20 years of London identity politics.
Tony Grew there. And in the course of his programme, Dave finds that some of the mayor's key principles conflict with each other. For example, the idea of listening to Londoners and the wish to devolve powers to local authorities. He takes his findings to the man himself.
I think you're right to identify the conflict, and you're right to say that it is sometimes hard. But I find that boroughs are very often looking for leadership. And I'm just amazed time and again with the planning decisions that we get, how often I'm told that even though it's a matter for the boroughs, they're quite keen to hear from the mayoralty and from the GLA about what we think. So there is an opportunity, there's a real opportunity to express our preferences for trying to save street markets wherever we can and for protecting green space. And it's weird how often it's simply the language, the mood music that emanates from City Hall that people are interested in. And so the conflict that you're right to identify, there is a conflict. We're not going to pretend there isn't a conflict between, you know, wanting to listen to the boroughs and wanting to set clear priorities. The conflict often doesn't pose itself in the way that it might.
And you can listen to Dave's full documentary for Comment is Free on The Guardian's website at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Now, this time of year isn't all about shopping, eating and drinking, nor even is it all about the birth of Christ. For those who celebrated the winter solstice yesterday, the shortest day of the year, it's a magical time of marking the end of one year and welcoming a new and, from today, although you might not have noticed it, a slightly brighter one. Martin Wainwright went to Castle Rigg in Cumbria to meet a family braving the dark and cold to witness the winter solstice.
I'm at Castle Rigg Stone Circle up in Cumbria. It's just before 7 o'clock, and I'm here because it's the winter solstice, which is the longest night of the year, but it also marks the beginning of the new year. The days start to get lighter, and as a result, it's the ancient festival of Yule, on which Christmas is largely based, putting greenery in the house and all that kind of thing, and celebrating the fact that things aren't going to get worse. At least we hope they're not. And I've just come down a lane in the dark and luckily discovered some people here. Do you mind telling me where you've come from?
We've come from Leeds. We came up last night, stayed in the local travel lodge. Mm-hmm. It's a traditional thing that we try and do. It's our fourth year.
Good. And I've come from Leeds as well, though. I got up early this morning. Why are you here?
It's something I've always wanted to do. I've always been interested in stone circles, and it's just to sort of pay our respects, you know, pay our respects to ancestors, relax before the madness of Christmas as well, just the two of us get away. And it's, we come every summer, we come every winter, we just like to be here for the solstice, to sort of see the sunrise and, you know, meet a few different people.
There is something special about these places, isn't there? I mean, this isn't... I gather there's going to be quite a lot of people at Stonehenge today, probably, but it's a very beautiful spot, this Castlerigg. I mean, do you mind? We can't see anything at the moment. Oh, yeah. The sun will be coming up in about, what, an hour?
It comes up in an hour, but you don't actually see it until about an hour after that because of the hills. Mm-hmm. So I think it was about 8:30 last year when we saw it finally crest the mountains. So we've got a fair old wait.
So I've got a little family here with two. How old are the two children?
Two and a half. And how old are you, Phoebe?
Six.
Six, good. And they're all clutching golden wrapped presents. I won't ask what's in them because that'll be something you'll find out later. And have you been hiding these among the stones or somebody?
Yeah, we have.
Phoebe, can you tell me what happened?
The fairy hid some presents.
Good. And where did they hide them?
Next to the stones.
Good. Was there one under each stone?
Yes.
So that's how many presents? That must be about 40 presents, will it be?
Yeah.
Maybe not quite that many. How far have you come, if I ask?
We've come from Caithley.
And do you come? Is it the first time you've been, or did you come?
First time I've been to the winter solstice, if that's what it's called. We usually do the summer or the spring.
I can see why people do the summer one. But it's we're lucky today, aren't we?
There's something magical about the winter solstice, anyway, isn't there? Even though the weather's really bad, it's still really nice.
Yes, and I suppose it's the beginning of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, it's worth celebrating, definitely, and it's good for the kids as well.
Mm, good. It's 8:15 now, and it's light. We've had official sunrise. The sun hasn't reached the stones yet because the mountains are in the way, but it's a lovely sight. There's now more than 30 people here, children rushing around, still collecting their little presents from the stone circle, from hidden beneath the stones. There's another circle nearby of Mole Hills, I've just noticed. Maybe they know something's going on, and there's this beautiful panorama of mist lifting off the mountains, great circle of mountains, some of the highest mountains in England, Helvellyn, Skiddaw, Blencathra, and passes in between. It's 8:30 now, and the little family from Keighley are having breakfast in their van. They've come in the traditional, what you might call, hippie way. There's a couple of vans, and they've got cooking chimneys with smoke pouring out of them. Up at the stones, there's now more like about, I think, 40 people here at the moment. There's more arriving all the time, and it's now completely light, but it's turning into what you might call a typical Lake District day of low cloud. There won't be an actual sunrise this morning, I don't think, but it's been a wonderful experience.
Martin Wainwright in Cumbria, and that's all from Guardian Daily today. We've two more before Christmas, so do join us again tomorrow. Phil Maynard produced the programme today. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.